Okay, we're on.
All right, welcome to Mustard Ayonnaise. I'm Matt.
I am Richard.
And we riff about things in the entertainment industry that pique our interest.
Absolutely.
We do not generate any new reporting or content. We simply riff on things. It's very lazy and we like it.
Exactly.
All right. Starting off on the list today, which today we're trying something new in that we're not in any way going in order in terms of thematic content.
The way it should be.
That's right. So we'll see what happens. Previously, I had, because we're both gigantic fans of the Larry Sanders Show, which was the HBO original series featuring Gary Shandling and a number of people you would recognize.
Exactly. It's possibly, I mean, I would say it's in the top five shows of all time.
It's brilliant. It is simply brilliant. And they've only released one season on DVD. And that was a couple years ago with one extra. I think it was an interview between Tom Shales and Gary Shandling.
And I don't think it was a couple years. I think it was like 5 years ago. I mean, it's been a long time.
And we're constantly, you know, how do you put out one season and then stop? Where are the rest? And you pointed out that it probably has to do with the whole Larry Pelicano.
Yeah, there's this scuzzbot attorney slash private investigator that is in deep with Brad Gray, who was Gary Shandling's former manager and partner. So Gary Shandling is suing this guy, and this guy hired Pelicano to investigate him, and it's this very, very troubled lawsuit that is, you know, taken over Hollywood. And it finally occurred to me, maybe the fact that Larry Sanders is totally in a major lawsuit against the guy who owns half of the Larry Sanders Show might have something to do with the fact that it's not
that's
on TV.
Probably a
and it's too bad, because honestly, I watch the show, I love the show, but it the longer distance away from it I go, the more it feels in its own way kind of dated. And I think the time to strike for that show was a couple of years ago for DVD, maybe not. But it'll come out someday, but I just kind of wish it had been the past couple of years. Yeah. And I would have owned them all.
Yeah, but and so it sucks that that's one of the casualties of this gigantic mess going on. We're not going to comment too much more about the mess.
We just want to see it on DVD.
Plenty of coverage about it, and it is so complex in terms of who's involved and how they're involved
the best part is when Pelicano hired some former mafia guy to terrorize a reporter because he was working on behalf of Steven Seagal. So he put like a dead fish in her car or something. And this reporter who's working for LA Times, nobody liked her. And they all thought she was making it up at the time because it sounded so much like right out of The Godfather. Somebody put a dead fish in my car or something. And it turns out all of this is totally true. It's like the craziest story ever.
Yeah, it's wacky. Yeah, and then there's been a lot of, there's been some press this week about the groundswell in public support for Snakes on a Plane.
Snakes on a Plane. Did you see the preview? Did you see the little...
I haven't seen the preview.
First of all, I'm excited about it because it's a dumb movie and it's in the whole title is designed to be this way. But there was a couple shots in the preview that looked decidedly really, really fake. And I was going, oh, I sure hope they clean this up.
Was it an official preview? I heard it was just like some early footage that had been put together.
Well, it's part of some official website where you're supposed to be like submitting your own music to for like a trailer or something. So they show all this footage.
Well, it's both clever and retarded.
It is. So, I mean, but it didn't look bad. I looked at that movie and going, what? This is a movie for me. I mean, it just looked really great. But there was a couple of snakes in that looked, you know, worse than Anaconda circa 1997. But it might be good. Apparently they went back and they've decided to film a whole bunch of more R-rated stuff because they decided they're going for an R rating regardless. So,
it's hysterical because this whole outgrowth of support stems from the name. And everybody just loves this name. And there's like T-shirts and posters and all this merchandise you can get online that fans have produced that you can get. And Sam Jackson is going around repeating the name wherever he can to keep the studio from changing it.
Exactly.
And I think by now the studio has woken up to the fact that they can't change the name.
It is the marketing campaign at this point.
It is now. They clearly didn't intend for it to be.
Yeah.
But God, and there was a screenwriter who had a blog entry, and I can't for the life of me remember who, or I think I got it through Jeff Wells and Hollywood Insider. But and the guy's got this great anecdote about the studio called him up, I think, to do a rewrite on the script, and they send him the script, and he calls him up the next day, and he says, First of all, it's the greatest title ever. You can't change this title. And the absolute silence on the other end. You're changing the title, aren't you? And there's more to it than that, but it's quite a phenomenon. And yeah. It sounds like the studio has decided to embrace it.
Yep.
So good for them. Good for them to recognize that and not fight it and to just go along with it.
Yeah, absolutely. So I've been hearing a couple early lead reviews of the Prairie Home Companion. And being a huge Robert Altman fan, I'm looking forward to this. But the more I thought about it, I realized, you know, I've seen a grand total of 2 Robert Altman movies in the theater, Gosford Park and The Player. And no other movie I've already seen in the theater. So I'm not so sure what I'm going to think about this. But you get the distinct feeling, if it's really good, it's going to be like a modern version of his movie Nashville, which was his great movie, one of his great movies of the 70s. But I don't know. I know you're kind of mezzo on it. I'm also intrigued to wonder how much input Paul Thomas Anderson had on this, because supposedly he was brought in as insurance on the studio and he's had a big part in it. And of course, I have seen every Paul Thomas Anderson film in the theaters. So I'd love to, you know, I don't know. I'm excited about it, but I'm not totally sure why. I like Prairie Home Companion, but, you know.
Is there a trailer out yet?
No, I haven't even seen the trailer.
Okay, so I don't feel... Well, if there is one out and we haven't seen it, shame on us for not having seen it before talking about it.
The thing that stunned me was that they mentioned that in that article that the movie is like 93 minutes long. And I'm going, Robert Altman? 93 minutes? I mean, the guy can't make a movie under 3 hours. And I was stunned by that, especially a movie as complex as this sounds. So I'm thinking it might be really great just because he's just, you know, he's cut it to the essence. Although I think it's funny that every dang time I see a movie, they always refer to it as a return. It's his best movie since Shortcuts. They always say his best movie since Shortcuts. And I'm always thinking, God, Gosford Park is a pretty damn good movie. And they're clearly dissing Gosford Park. I don't understand why. The thing was nominated for like 73 Academy Awards. And I just don't understand why they continually... What they're basically saying is it's a return to that style of Robert Altman movie, where it's like a... not a period piece like Gosford Park. But anyway, I always find that as a slam to his, quote, lesser movies that all, even his lesser movies like The Gingerbread Man and Dr. T and the Women, all are pretty dang good movies. I mean,
Dr. T. I saw Gingerbread Man, and I was thoroughly unimpressed.
Really?
I thought that was just...
I kind of liked it as
a
take on a thriller, and I always liked
Kenneth Branagh.
Yeah, Kenneth Branagh. I think it's funny to listen to his commentary tracks, because God bless Robert Altman, he does commentary tracks for all of his movies, and I'd say probably 60-70% of his movies usually feature some long, lingering, fully nude scene of some actress that typically doesn't do nude scenes. So, and invariably in his nude scene, while it's going on, he'll explain how uncomfortable the actress was, but how they're willing to do it, because, you know, it really was integral to this, you know, to the movie. And I kept thinking, it's amazing how he keeps putting out movies where they just happen to have long, lingering nude scenes that are integral to the movie. And in that movie, it was, I can't remember her name, she was in Schindler's List, and in Shortcuts, it was Julianne Moore. And, you know, it's just funny to hear him talk about nude scenes and how important they are, and how, God bless Robert Altman for making sure that it's important that there's a nude scene in every one of his movies. Anyway, I digress. So I have high hopes for Lindsay Lohan and Prairie Home Companion, even though it's already been marketed as a PG movie. You never know.
Right. And I like Paul Thomas Anderson. I think he's fantastic. There's a lot of great people in this movie. I have never heard... the show on NPR. It has zero interest for me. You know, so we'll see. I don't see myself rushing to go out and pay to see it in the theater. That strikes me as a more, is there anything else out? Yeah. I guess I'll go see this.
Like a DVD release that you borrow from me.
Well, that would definitely be the end of the line solution.
Yeah.
Maybe see it at the Crest or something. So I don't know. To me, the subject matter doesn't sound that interesting.
Yeah.
But if the reviewers that we like end up going ape over it,
yep.
I can see myself saying, okay, I trust these reviewers' opinions. I trust that I will like it as they say I will. So, and while we're on Altman, I borrowed your copy of McCabe and Mrs. Miller.
McCabe and Mrs.
And
Miller.
Watched it last week. Interesting. It shot beautifully. The snow at the end, it was, you know, I. I think it has to do with the quality of the transfer. I couldn't tell if it was real snow or fake optical snow.
No, it was all real snow, but it was the way they chose to shoot it. He very specifically shot that thing in all long lenses. He didn't want even the interior shots were the cameraman as far away from the actors as possible so they could feel totally intimate. And in that particular thing, because they were filming so far away, it looked like whiteout conditions, and that's exactly how they filmed
it. Well, I think it was just because it was the snow reflects the light oddly, yeah. And I think it was that odd quality that kind of drew attention to itself as, I can't tell if this is an optical laid over or real snow. Anyway, regardless of that, it was a beautiful movie.
I thought it was incredible, and I loved just how ultimately Warren Beatty's life, he's a nothing, and he just kind of ends in this sort of half-assed way, even though he's trying to live. The way they filmed that movie made you just feel how insignificant it is, how he's struggling, but he's kind of this dot struggling at the end of this movie, and it's just kind of over. It's this amazing movie. I've always loved this movie, but I mean, it's hard for me to judge it because I saw it like 20 years ago, and I've probably seen it 5 times since, so it's kind of burned into my cortex. But I don't know. What did you think of all the overlapping dialogue, his trademark?
I thought most of it was fine, but there were times when it seemed like, and I emailed you this about it, it seemed like the mix was bad. And you're like, no, he does that on purpose. And I'm thinking, well, except I couldn't hear anything. It wasn't that I couldn't hear one conversation over another. It's that everything was so subdued, I had to jack up the volume to get anything. And I felt like that it sounded to me like more of a mix issue or maybe a transfer issue.
It might have been. I understand
Altman's thing. I understand what he's going for in this instance, and it wasn't throughout the whole movie. It was just a couple of scenes. It felt like I shouldn't have had to strain that hard to hear anything.
Well, this is definitely one of those early, like late 90s Warner Brother DVD transfers, so who knows how much participation Altman had in listening to the soundtrack and seeing if it's the way he wanted it.
I tell you what, it sure imparted the feeling of a dirty frontier town, yeah. Of it being cold and wet and miserably muddy, and yeah. that really was effective.
Yeah.
It occurs to me that movies where there's opium usage depicted,
yep.
There's like this whole other vibe. It's like, okay, I get it. They're on opium and they're off in their own little world, and I can't help but think I'm constantly missing something.
Yeah.
Like it happened there. It happened in Once Upon a Time in America.
I love that movie, man. I watched it again and I realized there's so much that's weird about it that I didn't like, but man, that scene where he is stoned and that phone rings and it rings like 20 times the scene and you can't tell if it's later you realize it's a memory of it ringing. Is it happening right then and there? Is the weirdest vibe. But I don't know, that whole movie I thought was kind of based on weirdness, you know?
Yeah.
The fact that James Woods supposedly, their friend went off to become the senator and he just realized it. It's like, it's freaking James Woods. How could you not recognize the guy being the senator? It was kind of a dumb... reveal, but it was still I
agree. However, before TV was prevalent, yeah. I can see a lot of people who aren't active in politics necessarily not knowing what senators look like.
That's a good point.
You know, unless they follow, you know, the only place you're going to see pictures really is newspapers. Yeah. So unless you're following newspapers closely, I can see that. That's a really good point. Plenty of people in today's day and age have no idea what yeah. prominent senators look like or who certain people are. And every so often you come across that and you're like, are you stupid? And it's like, not everyone's into politics like you are. Let it
yeah.
go.
Yeah, no, that's a very good point. You're right.
Interestingly, the next thing on our little list here actually kind of ties into the audio mix.
Yep.
You see my segue?
Yes.
See how I did that smooth?
Dynamic.
That you sent along an article, which was a sound engineer writing about dynamic range, which I've known about for a while. And the issue is, CDs that have been released over the past, I can't even nail the exact time, let's say the past 10, 15 years, have progressively been mixed. Two things have been happening. They've been louder, and they've been, the mix has been less dynamic so that it's compressed. So what happens is if you take an old CD, a classic CD, like a Beatles CD, and you rip it into a sound mixing program, and you can see the peaks, and you can see the highs and the lows in the music.
Classic waveform.
Right, waveform stuff. You take any CD from today, doesn't matter, any CD, put that in, rip it, look at the waveform, it's all it's all,
it's all tops, no valleys, and it's all, and it's totally clipped at the tops. It's just like
pure... Right. It's like everything, it's maxed out as hard as it can go. It's like they mixed it hot, and it's a reduction in audio quality so that they can have loud CDs.
And
so
that his point was, that's part of the reason why music sucks now, is because people are it, they're just sonically not there. It's, you're not noticing as much, but it's sonically not there. I don't know. All I know is actually editing this podcast together, you realize how screwed up it is if you're maxing it out every time. It just sounds horrible.
Well, it's, you know, I have a part-time job at a radio station that's, you know, sort of waxed and waned in terms of how involved I've been over the years. And one of the guys who was in charge of importing new music into the computer system, you know, I'd go in and hang out with him, and he'd say, look, you know, look at this. And he was disgusted as he was importing new music. And he'd say, look at the lack of depth in this track and this information. And then he'd do exactly that. He'd take an old CD and say, now look, compare to this. And so, you know, professionals are very aware of this. Radio stations are very aware that this is going on, and they're not happy about it, but I don't know what they're doing about it. I'm not much of an audiophile. I can't, you know, you put a classical CD in one set of speakers and then run it through a professional set of speakers, I don't know that I could really discern that much difference. I don't think I have that good an ear. So I don't know that I could even discern the quality between an older CD or an older recording and a newer recording where it's all maxed out. That being said, go back. It's not going to happen, but go back and please just, you know, get the quality back up there. You don't need to max out the levels. It's just completely unnecessary. And I have no trail. I have no end to that thought. It's just a bunch of trailing off.
It's just an appeal from Mustard Ayonnaise to the audio technicians of the world. Go back. Look into the light.
Okay.
Let's move on to South Park.
Go ahead.
Well, so you probably saw that, and I don't know what's going on honestly now, but they canned Chef from South Park specifically because, well, he quit. But did he quit? Because you've got Scientology spokesman saying he quit. Then you've got Isaac Hayes' best friend saying, no, he had kind of a stroke, and he's recovering, and he loves South Park. And then you're listening, that somebody played a quote from, it was some audio interview that he did like 8 months. You know, people forget that Tom Cruise episode, that came out like 6-7 months ago. This is not some new thing. So right after it was over, somebody interviewed Isaac Hayes on some audio blogger, and I was listening, he goes, oh yeah, I think it's funny. No, I don't have a problem with it. No problem whatsoever. And all of a sudden now, not Isaac Hayes. Did you hear once Isaac Hayes be interviewed about this? No.
I didn't really look around.
Well, he wasn't. He simply wasn't. It was some statement that was saying that he was opposed to this. And now I'm hearing one of his friends say that, and by the way, for those who don't know what we're talking about Isaac Hayes, the famous singer of Shaft, who's played Chef on South Park, and a noted Scientologist who quit / got fired from South Park recently for being opposed to, or for supposedly coming out against their big anti-Scientology episode that made fun of Tom Cruise and so forth. But anyway, his friend was saying that, no, Chef, he had a stroke. He was recovering, but he would have never said that. He thought that the episode was great.
Oh, well, so, I didn't hear that last part. I mean, it sounds like, for whatever reason, Scientology has been upping their PR offensive the last year.
Yeah.
Mostly
to great effect, too. I mean, they really, people are jumping on the Scientology bandwagon.
Oh, man. And so all this goes on, and then South Park does one of their one-week turnarounds, where they produce an entire episode in an insanely short amount of time.
But
like,
you know, they do that every week. That's the way they do their episodes.
I didn't know that they did it every week, because not the ones where it's obvious aren't that many, where it's, you know, you're dealing with topical events. But you're just slamming those down, aren't you? Gonna have to have an intervention. You know, like the first time they did it, was the Elian Gonzalez one, where they did the raid, and like that Wednesday, it's in the South Park, and you're just like, holy crap, that's insanely fast. Anyway, the ones to me that have been obvious that were done very fast were always hysterical. This one, did you see it?
You mean the one where they killed him off? Yeah. I actually missed it.
I thought it was funny. I didn't think it was hysterical. And what they said, last time on South Park. And they sort of pretended like there had been a part one where Chef decides he needs to wring more out of life and he joins the Super Adventurers Club. And then he comes back. And this is part two where he's back. And they've very consciously edited the entire performance together from past audio clips. And that was actually the funniest part where you get, hello, children. You know, I want to make love to the children. So basically, they made Chef a child molester. I want to lay you down by the fire and have sex with you, with the children. And it was, oh man, that was funny. And the whole gist of the episode is the Super Adventurers Club is really a bunch of child molesters, and all they do is go and have incest with kids around the world. And the kids are all, you know, this isn't Chef. Chef isn't like this. He's been brainwashed by this stupid club. And even as at the end of the episode, Chef dies. Yeah. He's going across a rope bridge. It's on fire. He falls, hits rocks, is impaled. A mountain lion and a bear both rip him apart. It's absolutely disgusting. He's shot. And the whole time the kids are like, oh, Chef, we love you. If only this retarded club hadn't turned you against us. And so it's clear that, you know, the creators, Matt and Trey, it seems like they don't have anything against Isaac. It's against Scientology and whatever. If the Scientologists made Chef quit, that's something. But it's just tremendously interesting.
Did you see the original episode that was based on? I hadn't seen that. I found it to be just. I didn't find it funny personally at all. And I thought that I don't know. It was simply we're gonna go after Scientology, and they just like laid out stupid Scientology, which it is stupid, but it was not to me. I didn't find it as clever, and I thought the whole in the closet thing, the spoof on R. Kelly, was funny, but went on way too long.
Okay, see, I thought that whole episode was very good. Difference of opinion.
Different strokes to move the world. By the way, I just noticed I was like talking on the wrong side of the microphone, so if it sounded funny for the last 15 minutes,
it looked like your waveform was okay. I noticed that, but I didn't want to point it out to you because I didn't want to make you feel inferior.
Anyway, in terms of South Park, they literally record them 1 week at a time. They were talking about it on Letterman this week, and they were pointing out that how easy it is because they do have other animators and stuff working on. But basically, because they're the voices, they write the thing, they can sit here and at the last minute just slap in new words and do everything literally to hours before they go on air. They don't always try to do that, but they do it quite often. And they say they start out the year with a rough outline of some of the episodes, but pretty much they don't write them till that week and just put them together. It's basically like Saturday Night Live every week. They're just writing an episode.
Interesting.
So anyway, what's up next, dude?
V for Vendetta. Did you see it yet?
I haven't seen it yet. What'd you think?
Dude, you got to see some movies for us to back and forth properly.
I know. I've been working kind of hard lately.
Okay. I quite enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I thought it was a very good adaptation of a graphic novel in terms of it took the important elements and I think properly represented them.
So can Alan Moore suck the Wachowski's donkey balls at this point?
No. I mean, I don't want to get into that again because I think we've discussed the Alan Moore thing multiple times to great length. I don't want to rehash it. They added a couple of things which weren't in the graphic novel, which, in my opinion, didn't really degrade anything. The ending is a little different, which I didn't think was going to work. And then it was okay. I was okay with it.
What was the original ending?
Okay, spoiler alert. The original ending is that the masses don't end up marching on Trafalgar Square or Parliament with each with their own mask and cape. What happened at the ending is pretty much the main character V is dead. He has been mortally wounded, and he asks that the girl Evie give him a Viking funeral. So she puts his body on this subway train that he has rigged full of explosives. And the subway train is sent to Parliament where it explodes. And then Evie sort of dons the mantle, wears the mask and the cape as the new V to help the people move from that point forward. So there really isn't any I mean, it's a marking point. It's a point of change, but there really isn't any resolution.
That's in the graphic novel.
Right. And,
and did they change this because of the subway bombings, or do they think? Or
no, because actually the thing still blows, the subway train still blows up under the thing, only this time there's all these masses of people are there to watch it and to rise up. It wasn't as cheesy as I thought it would be. I thought Natalie Portman was very good. She continues to be extremely hot, even with the shaved head. Hugo Weaving was good, but you really could have had the first guy, I forget his name, James, say Portnoy, Pure or something.
Perfroy.
I don't really know what he was doing badly enough that they decided
that's
to switch
so
to
weird.
Hugo.
I mean, the fact that you couldn't even see his face and he was so bad. I mean, what is
going
on?
Well, I don't know. I can see, because it's when you're an actor and you can't use your face, that's a tremendous tool that's lost. And you've got to use body language and how you carry yourself. And, you know, if the director didn't like what he was getting, or the producers, you know, I can see that. But just the same.
I'm just trying to think about that. The only other time in history I can remember that happening would be Plan 9 from Outer Space, when Bela Lugosi died about 20 minutes of footage. So they replaced him with the Ed Wood's dentist, who was about 2 feet taller than Bela Lugosi.
I don't know.
Nobody would notice.
I don't know. Anyway, I thought it was a great film. I thought the director, James McTeague, which was the Wachowski's first AD on the Matrix stuff, I thought he did a great job. I was quite happy with it. I was happy with it.
Cool. Well, I'm looking forward to see it. I just been friggin' busy, so.
Next on the list, Inside Man.
No, you saw that. What did you think?
Yes. Well, it doesn't matter when
I
saw it.
At some point
yesterday. Yesterday morning. Great friggin' movie.
Really?
Absolutely fantastic. I loved it. I'd already heard some stuff, like it's got a great opening credit sequence because it's got this Indian song that's really catchy and. But it really is true. It's got a great song, and it's this van going around picking up the perpetrators of the heist. But it's shot really well. I like the way they did the credits in terms of the graphics. The song is catchy, and I was a little irritated when it ended. I'm like, no, I want another 5 minutes of this. I was really into it.
Every once in a while, David Chase will do that on The Sopranos. He'll have like a 5-minute opening musical thing that it's so dang good that it just kills you, and I'm surprised more movies don't bring you into the mood of a movie that way.
Yeah,
when it works, it really works.
And it's not that it was especially creative, because it's the van driving around New York picking people up, but it was really well executed. Lots of interesting camera angles, just really well put together. And the movie itself, I thought Spike Lee did a fantastic job.
Yeah, he's a good director.
Who
makes a lot of cruddy movies.
And it's shocking, because I haven't seen that many Spike Lee movies, quite honestly. They don't hold a lot of interest to me. But, you know, something like this, which has a broader appeal, which is sort of code for saying it's not a black movie, necessarily, and I feel horrible for saying it, but it's not...
It's to me, it has nothing with that. It's a specific kind of black movie, I guess what I'm saying, because there's plenty of, quote, black movies that hold a lot of appeal, but most of his movies I just think are terrible.
Your levels are just really low. You need to...
Right, am I talking right?
That's
right,
better.
I'll talk right up there. Yeah, some of his movies that he does are just...
You're peaking high.
So some of his movies that he does are just terrible. Like I'm thinking of, what was it, Crooklyn, Girl 6. You can go down this list of all these movies that nobody even remembers that were so bad.
There's a bunch I haven't seen, so I can't comment on them.
Yeah, they're
but
just,
they just
they're
they
terrible.
They didn't look that interesting. But this is a great film. And you know, some of the reviews point out that he really gets under some of the characters and addresses racism in some different ways.
Sweet.
And he does, and it's not, you don't feel like you're being beaten over the head with it.
How's Jodie Foster?
Good. She looks good for however old she is.
Well, she's not that old, but she is. She's about as good of an actress as ever been in Hollywood. And when you think back of the movies she's been in, it's like even movies that aren't all that good like that. What was that movie last year?
Flight Plan. Which I have zero interest in.
Yeah, it was a terrible movie, but she's, of course, incredibly good in it. She only does a movie every couple of years, and she's so good. She's just an incredibly good actor. She's very reserved, and you never quite know what's going on beneath the surface, but she's just an incredibly good actress.
And, you know, and as I watch the film, and after you see it, I'm curious to know, because our our bitch ahead of time was that the trailer gives away too much.
Yeah.
You know, you've got Denzel Washington screaming at the door, "This ain't no bank robbery." And, yeah. "Oh, they bugged us. They've been listening to every word."
Yeah.
And so it's like, God dang it. I bet that's a 2/3 of the way through Revelation, and you just screwed it for me.
Yeah.
Thanks a bunch. But I'm curious to know how, after you've seen it, how would you have marketed it?
Cool.
What would you have chosen to give away? Because it isn't just the standard heist. And, you know, just about everybody who's seen it points that out. You know, it keeps you guessing, and it's ahead of you, and it's pretty intelligent, and it is.
Yep.
And so if you market it as a standard heist movie, you know, and I love heist movies. If it looks like a clever heist movie, even a crappy heist movie, if it's a good trailer, I'll want to see it.
Cool.
Eventually, my desire will die down by the time it actually comes out.
Yeah.
But I'll want to see it. Like, oh God, what was that De Niro and Ed Norton and Marlon Brando thing? Frank Oz directed it.
Yeah. Oh God.
Might have even been called The Heist.
Terrible movie. What the heck was the name? Yeah, it was something like that. But it was a terrible movie.
Yeah, and that was very disappointing.
Yeah. All these powerhouse actors, I mean, literally some of the best powerhouse actors of their generation, managing to screw up a movie. So,
anyway.
And you can see why they all signed on to it. Brando signed on for one of his infamous late career paydays. De Niro signing on for probably the opportunity to work with Ed Norton. Ed Norton going, "Oh my God, it's Marlon Brando and De Niro." And none of them really going, "Do we have the right director? Is this the right script?"
Well, it sucks because I don't want to say anything bad about Frank Oz. He's Yoda. He's Miss Piggy.
Yeah.
How can you get on? Anyway, I'm curious to know, after you see it, what your approach to marketing it would have been.
I'm looking forward to seeing it.
So next on the list, you emailed me this thing this morning, which I barely saw. Brokeback Mountain and Randy Quaid.
Well, Randy Quaid has decided to sue the producers of Brokeback Mountain for lying to him, claiming that this was a small independent movie that was that he was going to appear in that had no prospects for making money, therefore they couldn't pay him anything. And then later he decided, no, they thought they were going to make a buttload of money on this, and they screwed him out of his profits or what he could potentially make from this movie. It's the most insane lawsuit that I think I've ever heard of. What is he thinking? I mean, it's like, well, first of all, every movie gets made. They hope they make $10 zillion on it. And who knows how and what's going to go on. But, I mean, God, he's in one of the most critically acclaimed movies of the year. He regularly works in Hollywood, but this definitely ups his cash as being a...
What movie that was...
Hang on just a second, folks. We're going to pause here. There we go. Okay. So anyway, he's been in a bunch of different movies, and he regularly works. But it's sort of like Bruce Willis taking small parts in an indie movie, ups his cash.
No, what was the movie he was in?
This one here, Brokeback Mountain.
Randy Quaid was in it,
Randy Quaid was in Brokeback Mountain.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, Randy Quaid.
I thought the point of the article was that he wasn't in it and was
No, okay, he was in it, and he's pissed that they didn't pay him more money because now it's looking to make $100 million.
Oh, I gotcha.
It's like, oh my God, dude, get over yourself. It's called a career. I mean, the guy's been making movies for 30 years, and now he decides to do a dumb move like this. I mean, it just blows me away. The Movie City News called it career suicide, and it's hard for me to disagree. I'm stunned that his lawyer didn't go, "Dude, I can file this for if you're telling me to, but I'm begging you not to." I mean, I don't know what he's thinking.
Wow.
Anyway, because he says he regularly gets about $1 million a movie, and this one here he agreed to do it for like $100,000 or something because everybody else is doing it for cheap.
You know my thinking on that? That was a Family Guy one-off joke where they were on a plane. You know what? I think it actually was The Simpsons. And they were on a plane, and they're like, "Oh, look at what the in-flight movie is," and then it's like, "Oh, well, they're actually shooting another movie on the plane. It'll be on the plane before we land." Then it was Randy Quaid.
Randy
you're just
Quaid.
Like, "Yep, that sounds about right."
Yeah.
So that's fascinating. I didn't realize he was in it, and is now, and yeah, that really does seem like kind of a how does he think this is positive in any way, shape, or form?
You would think, knowing in Hollywood, I mean, you never know if a movie's going to be successful or not. And, of course, you want every movie to be successful. How could he get mad that that a movie that was pitched to him as probably a small movie would do well. That's how every single movie that is not a blockbuster is pitched to every actor. You know that going in. You don't get paid anything. I mean, there's movies where they point out it's a point of pride. I'm not going to get paid. I did my own makeup. I had to drive myself to the set, but I got a chance to work with this. I mean, it's just, oh God, hang on just a second. Here comes my mom again on the phone. Okay, we're back. We took a little break there. Mr. Brown, we are on.
Do you want to finish your thought about the Randy Quaid thing?
Oh, he's an idiot. That's my thought. What a friggin' moron. I mean, seriously, how dumb can you possibly be? Anyway.
Okay, so next
one. Ah, Seen It, our favorite DVD game.
Well, not necessarily.
My favorite DVD game.
Well, we discussed this where some family member gotten it for you and then for Christmas, and then you played it, and because it was you went first and got everything right, you shut them out.
Absolutely.
You dominated.
The greatest day of my life, as I refer to it.
Well, I didn't know that. Wow. I'm a little sad for you.
It was so awesome to, like, literally, you know, not have them. I don't know. It was just incredible. It was so awesome.
So then I played it for the first time a couple months ago and had a very muted reaction because it was... I failed to dominate like I thought I would. It was very distressing to my sense of self-worth.
Mm-hmm.
If there's one thing I'm good at, it's movie quotes from the 80s, I think, would actually be the thing that I'm best at. But I was very disappointed. I think out of three games, my team won one.
Jeez.
However, we played it again last week. And this time, I dominated as I was supposed to.
Mm-hmm.
I think my team swept 3-for-3.
Good for you.
While other things were going on in the kitchen, we were just running randomly going through the DVD and running questions, and I was getting them all. Good. Although the one I didn't get was, what is the name of Michael Fox's mom in Back to the Future?
Michael J. Fox's mom?
No, the other Michael Fox.
Well, Michael Fox from Lost? Or that's Matthew
that's
Fox.
That's Matthew Fox.
Michael, I just never ever have heard him ever referred as Michael Fox.
Maybe we don't need to buy into his whole use my middle initial.
Okay, I'd have to think about it. His dad was George McFly. Marty.
So what was her full name before getting married?
George, Marty, and...
And I had no frigging idea, as I think I shouldn't have to.
No, you
as
shouldn't.
As a movie nerd, that's a little too... down in the weeds.
Let's think about it. Maybe by the end of this podcast, I'll come up with it.
There was a woman there that knew.
Wow.
I was, and I'm full credit to her.
Well, keep thinking about it. I'll see if I can come up with it.
Okay. Anyway, I was just very pleased in my performance with Seen It last time, where I dominated like I'm supposed to. Because, you know, and everyone else is looking at me like I'm a freak, which is fine. And I would explain to them, you don't understand. This is the one thing I can do. This is my talent. It's not a marketable talent. I can't go get paid to do this as my job. So this is what I do.
Well, I was thinking about it the other day. You know, I was listening to Howard Stern, and they had one of his sidekicks is Artie Lang. And Artie Lang commits literally, apparently not with that many viewings, but he's got literally the entire... Godfather movie committed to memory. So they would start playing stuff and he would just start going through scenes with like the meetings of the families and talking about this or when Luca Brasi at the beginning is trying to explain to Marlon Brando that, you know, his gift on his daughter's wedding, and he goes this and it's so funny, and he'll go through 5-minute scenes and they're dumbfounded. It's so funny, and they're asking him, I mean, how many times you see us? Oh, he says, I've probably seen it like maybe 10 times. And last time I saw it was like 10 years ago, but he's a comedian and comedians can commit this stuff. And I've noticed with you, I remember we used to sit there and watch The Big Lebowski over and over, and you could just riff off that stuff like crazy. And I knew it all.
Like Rain Man, I think is what you said.
Exactly. But honestly, I can't do it. I'm like totally visually oriented. I used to have this habit or this ability to see any 10 seconds of any film filmed in like the last 20 years, any 10 seconds of it, and even establishing shots, and I could tell you what the movie was and a bunch of stuff about it. But if it was listening to a quote, I wouldn't get it, because it's like I'm not auditorily inspired, I guess. But anyway, so I just thought it was incredible.
Actually, you're mentioning Stern a minute ago. Reminds me of something else I forgot to put on our list.
What's up?
They are finalizing the deal for new episodes of Futurama.
Oh, yeah. How exciting. Oh, yeah, Billy West.
That is so frigging sweet.
Unbelievable.
Billy West posted it to his blog, and there's some confusion over whether or not the episodes will actually air to TV or go straight to DVD. It sounds like they're going to go straight to DVD after some initial confusion. I don't care as long as I get new episodes of Futurama.
My only concern with straight to DVD is there might be some reason for them to try and do them on the cheap or something. You know what I'm saying?
Well, you'd have to assume that the people behind it, Groening and David X. Cohen, would not, X. Cohen being
his nom de plume.
Yes. Not actually an X.
It's S.
You have to assume that they wouldn't agree to do it unless they could maintain the quality.
Yeah, you would hope, but, you know. Anyway, I couldn't imagine better news than that.
That was, I sent you an email that I can't, the contents of which I cannot repeat because it's a little blue, but
yeah,
it was great frigging news. Can't wait.
Well, speaking of other TV news, did you hear they they say he's leaving voluntarily, but essentially they finally forced Mike Wallace to essentially quit or almost quit.
I can buy that it's voluntary.
According to some others that I've said, he definitely doesn't want to do it. They've been trying to they pay him an enormous amount of money. They've been trying to slowly push him out for the past few years, and he agrees to cut down on the number of stories he's doing, and then they describe stories of him rushing to the fax machine to get story leads before everybody else, and he's pumping out as many stories as he's ever done, and they love him, but by the same token, they're saying this is literally an 87-year-old man, and he's not attracting younger demographics. You know,
well, for
that
crying
whole thing.
Out loud, 60 Minutes is never going to attract younger.
Well, they did force out Don Hewitt, and that was definitely against his will. This is all that idiot Les Moonves who runs that network.
You know, trying to make 60 Minutes appeal to younger viewers is ridiculous, and it's a loser's game. If they do that, they're going to lose. It's going to suck. It'll eventually be canceled. The only thing, what they continue to make quality programming. Younger viewers who care about it will find it.
I agree.
I'm 30. I like 60 Minutes just fine. I found that I wanted quality reporting. I still think it's pretty good stuff.
I think the thing that kills me about the whole Mike Wallace thing is the fact that Mike Wallace, he started 60 Minutes after a long and distinguished career. He started when he was 50. I mean, it's just unbelievable that he has been around doing this as long as he was.
Apparently his kid's on Fox and is a complete boob.
Yeah.
Every so often I'll see some comment about something he's made.
Oh, you mean Chris Wallace?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Boob.
Yeah. Anyway.
All right. So that now we're sort of into DVD land of stuff we've seen or bought recently. I already talked about McCabe.
Yeah.
I also saw Frantic with Harrison Ford for the first time last week. And previously, I'd only known about this movie from the Bare Naked Ladies song.
This is the one. This is the Roman Polanski one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
the Manuel Signet and.
So we put this in, my girlfriend and I, and Boy, it's hard to think of another movie that screams the 80s more than this one. It is so dated.
Yeah.
It is so in the moment. And, you know, that's fine. Some movies are like that.
Yeah.
But with the music and the French nightclubs and the whatever people are wearing and the hair, whoa.
The most 80s movie of all time, bar none, and it's a good movie, is To Live and Die in L.A. With the guy from
William Peterson.
There's some movies that they scream that and you're going, oh, I can't watch another second. And others, it's just like you get into it. Did you get into Frantic at all?
Not really. I think I kept expecting more than I got. Because the packaging, it's like, you know, this is Polanski's best sense, whatever. You know, this is a first-rate thriller. And honestly, I thought it was a very rote, un-first-rate thriller. I thought it was a third-rate thriller.
Yeah.
You know, it's just kind of a Harrison Ford's wife disappears and he tracks her down, tries to figure out what happens, and there's nothing wrong with it. It just completely and utterly failed to engage me. Yeah. And for all the hype on the hype on a box is one thing, but, you know, I understand Roman Polanski is a name director with some drama attached to him, and it's got Harrison Ford in it. And with all of that, I kind of wanted to believe the hype, but I just found myself being pretty disappointed. And then actually at the end, when you realize that you know, some of the secret, you know, you've got the bad guy Arabs, and then some of the secret agents are Americans and they're kind of clueless, and then some of the other secret agents are Jews, and it's the most offensive stereotyping of Jews. I'm surprised they didn't have Hasidic, you know, hair ringlets, you know, and
I guess he can get away with it because he's Jewish.
I guess, but in I didn't realize it at first, but once I realized they were Jewish, I'm like, oh my God, I'm incredibly offended, and I'm not Jewish, and how, ugh. Anyway, I was surprised at how disappointed I was.
I hear you.
And then I rewatched Starship Troopers the other night.
Yeah, what'd you think?
Well, the same thing I've thought the other times I've seen it.
That it's perhaps the greatest, most underrated movie of the past 10 years?
No.
That would be my thinking. I love that movie.
I think it's a fun movie. I think it's it has a very specific vibe to it that by and large works.
It captures it very well. It's design. The people that didn't like it seemed to, that I saw that didn't like it, particularly critics, seemed to think that it was being overt rather than covert. They seemed to think it was like, they're going, these actors, they're so wooden, and they're so, and it's like, that it's fascist. And they didn't seem to even remotely consider that that was the point. It was trying to point out how crazy this kind of thought process is and how this would work. I mean, it stunned me that they thought that. They got it with RoboCop. They saw that RoboCop was an attempt to promote a fascist world without saying we support it. They're saying this is the logical result of this. And same with this movie, and they just didn't seem to get it.
Well, the biggest problem for me watching it again was the dialogue needs... A lot of the dialogue feels clunky. They had a lot, but some of the dialogue feels very clunky, and you're like, you know, that needed a polish.
Yeah.
Or that delivery needed to be tweaked because it, ooh, that fell flat. Because, I mean, by and large, through most of it, I buy Denise Richards as the Starship pilot, which, how big a reach does that have to be? I buy it for whatever reason. And anyway, for me to do that, the movie's got to be pretty...
Well, you know what's funny about the dialogue? I of course own every Paul Verhoeven movie ever made on video except for Showgirls because there's no commentary track. And the reason why I own them is because they're such crazy weird movies. And what's funny is all of his Dutch movies, and I've got like 8 of his movies that are Dutch movies, they actually have a similar vibe to these movies in that you get the feeling like they were recorded by actors speaking in not their native language kind of thing. And I mean that in a sense that you just get the feeling that they're using dialogue that they don't quite understand and that they loop later. So you watch them and they'll like laugh or they'll have weird emotions that I used to find bizarre. I don't know if you remember when you were a kid, did you watch Pippi Longstocking or any of those movies? Okay. And you notice how they always seemed like a little bit too much emotion. And then the dialogue, because it was dubbed, it was just this weird kind of like people would burst into laughing for no reason. And then they would like have this overt expressions on their faces. Well, that's the way almost all of Verhoeven's movies are. There doesn't seem to be an ounce of realism in the acting. And I love that. So I was watching Starship Troopers and it just seems like a continuation of his Dutch movies. It's just a weird feel to me that is different from other ones. And a lot of it relies in this dialogue. So I don't know. I love it. I get into it totally. And I just look for them as opportunities to, another great soundtrack is coming down the pike. The ones that are the most conventional movies, the ones I like the least, like Hollow Man, totally a conventional Verhoeven movie. And I liked it the least. Huh. Even Basic Instinct, pretty conventional compared to his stuff. And I like it the least, but some of his other ones, some of his early ones like Spetters and other ones, I mean, they're just the greatest commentary tracks you'll ever hear because the movies are so goddamn bizarre. Okay. Anyway, I digress. Alrighty. I'm sorry. I love Starship Troopers. When Starship Troopers first came out, I was I actually got a phone call from one of those movie studio marketing companies.
Oh, yeah?
And they were asking me, okay, what movies have you seen lately? What have you done? And it realized that they were getting around to Starship Troopers. And the reason is because they were basically asking me, hey, get down, Cat. What they were doing was they were basically trying to figure out, did I as a consumer think this movie was supposed to be PG-13 or R? And they were essentially trying to gauge whether they should recut this movie to a PG-13 and market it that way because it had done so poorly in its initial release. And they were trying to figure out, was it the generic weird title? Was it that it seemed like a Star Wars movie and was really something more violent? And I hate to tell them, but you know, they called the wrong person because I love the movie and I got why it was called Starship Troopers from the Heinlein novel and everything. And so in one small part, I was probably the reason that that movie didn't get recut into a PG-13. And for that, I'm proud. Anyway, hey, I got some new DVDs. I got The Stuntman. Have you ever seen The Stuntman?
Nope.
That is one of the great movies of all time about movie making. It was filmed in like 1978 by this director named Richard Rush. He had spent 10 years trying to get financing for this movie. And then it sat on a shelf for like 2 years. They refused to release it. And they finally like sent it to like one theater in Seattle and a theater like in Vancouver and other places. And it did gangbuster business. So they finally decided to release this thing. But it's about this mad director played by Peter O'Toole. And as Barbara Hershey in it and Steve Railsback and all these other people, ended up getting nominated for a gaggle of Academy Awards. But it is a great, great movie. And I was excited to find a copy on a DVD. What are you giggling about?
The television. Peter O'Toole.
Minoku Industries.
It's one of those things that, there will all forever be an association with something else. So unfortunately, Peter O'Toole, along with Burgess Meredith, are now permanently associated with the Mr. Show sketch.
As Johnny Carson.
The House of the Future. The couch, Burgess Meredith.
Well, so speaking of Mr. Show,
oh man,
have you seen Sky High yet?
No.
Okay, Sky High, an unheralded movie that is truly great on so many levels. It's this movie about it's kind of like, I guess, The Incredibles. It's this family of superheroes, and the tone is just perfect. It's a kids' movie, but it is so well put together. But anyway, speaking of, there is two characters that are Dave Foley and Kevin McDonald from Kids in the Hall that are fantastic in this movie. Dave Foley being a former sidekick. I can't remember his name. It was something. He's like teaching these students. But anyway,
was it Mansurban Hecubus?
No, it wasn't Mansurban Hecubus. It was something. His name was like Incredible Boy. But since he's talking to the students, you can just call me Mr. Boy. That's what his name is. But anyway, and Kevin McDonald is this alien with this giant head, and it's so goddamn funny. But anyway, and there's a brief snip at the end of cameo with Jill Talley and Tom Kenny from Mr. Show, which was like, yay, it was exciting. Anyway, the movie is great. The tone is great. It's well done. It's not a perfect movie, but it's a great movie, and it should have done huge business. I don't think it did that poorly, but it should have done awesome. I mean, it was such a great movie. And then I also got Monty Python's The Meaning of Life, and that's a... It was never a particularly good Monty Python movie. It was really a surreal movie in a sense. And it's the worst of all their DVDs because it has a commentary, and it's got a commentary by the two Terrys, Terry Gilliam and Terry Jones. And it's the most boring of the commentaries.
Really?
They're like asleep through half of it. They're hardly commenting. It's not particularly funny. It's just definitely kind of a half-hearted release, which is too bad. Because there are other ones, the other DVDs they did for Life of Brian and The Holy Grail are just fantastic. So anyway, there ends my DVD purchases for the week.
Okay. Last one I got was Mirror Mask.
Oh, yeah.
Which I haven't watched yet. I watched the supplemental stuff. I haven't watched or listened to the commentary yet. But
one of the cooler releases of the past year, just the story behind it.
Especially when you look at how much they were able to do with the resources they had, which is essentially Dave McKeon, who's, you know, a graphic artist, with a team of like 15 to 20 just out of art school people put this thing together. And it doesn't at all look like a team of 15 art students put it together. It's very well done. And the fact that they were able to do this for what I'm sure was no money.
Yeah.
Really is, it's astounding. It's an incredible testament to a first-time director's skill and the skill of everyone involved. I mean,
it's interesting how Jim Henson Studios is still around and still gets involved in these weird little one-off things.
You know, it's because they look at Labyrinth and they look at Dark Crystal and they're like, we're making a ton of money off these things.
But
let's do another one.
But don't forget, Dark Crystal was a huge flop. and Labyrinth didn't make much money either. Both of those movies.
I think now with cults and DVD, well, cults, with, you know, midnight screenings and DVDs and the ability to great to better make money off of a cult following, I think they're doing fine now.
Well, I you know, every once in a while, it's like you forget that Jim Henson Studios even exists. And then, do you remember the movie that came out about 10 years ago about Alice in Wonderland as she grew up? And it was, what was it called? But it was like she was like 80 years old and she was revisiting her past. But anyway, and a lot of it was a fantasy sequence, and it was Jim Henson puppets going back and visiting. It was the most whacked, cool, but Henson kind of thing.
I mean, these films now have a big cult following, so they wanted another one, but they didn't want to take a bath on it, which is why the budget was so small. They're like, we want a film like this, and here's the budget we had to do it in, and I think it'll work in terms of being able to make them money in the future, because the overhead was so small.
Well, that's the thing. I just think to maintain a studio's like a little environment where you do these.
Well, and I've heard some weird things about Jim Henson Studios in terms of what they've been trying to do, and in terms of like going back and forth with the Muppets. And now that, you know, Disney owns the Muppets, and is Disney going to do anything with them? And, you know, which of the Henson children actually cares about running the studio and which wants to get out of it? I mean, there's random Hollywood drama sort of surrounding it. I really don't know where I was going with that.
But then I go, like, you hear Peter Jackson, and you hear that the only reason he got involved with Halo was to keep Weta running, because, you know, in between big projects, we got to get more big projects to keep going here. And Jim Henson Studios, like, I'll hear every couple of years something they're involved in. I'm going, so is this, do they just get together at that time? Are they doing stuff in the interim? I mean, how?
Well, they were doing Farscape for a long time.
Oh, were they? Okay. Yeah. So, okay. Yeah, well, that makes sense. Absolutely. So anyway, not much else to say.
Okay. Then I guess we can wrap up. This is Matt.
This is Richard.
And you've been listening to Mustard Ayonnaise. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's how you're going to do it, your little robotic. Thank you.